we just figured that everybody would just would live at the beach house all summer, kind of like the real world. But then they were really living together,
yeah.
And they were really all having sex with each other.
Yeah.
This is like a weird lab experiment.
And welcome to Reason TV. I'm Kennedy, and tonight we are celebrating the release of my book, The Kennedy Chronicles, The Golden Age of MTV Through Rose-Colored Glasses. And it's a firsthand account of my time at MTV in the 90s. David Knott, the president of Reason, called it a kiss and tell. A lot of kissing, but not a lot of other stuff going on in the book. But the reason that I have a career at all in broadcasting is because of the man that I'm sitting here with right now. His name is Andy Schoen. And when I was an 18-year-old intern at a radio station here in Los Angeles, he was the program director. And for some insane reason, which I'll never quite fully grasp, he hired me to be a part-time DJ. And that's when my broadcast career really began. And then Andy left and moved to MTV in the spring of 1992. By the fall, well, he had axed everybody. It was a bloodbath, and they needed new VJs. And that's when you hired
that's
me,
right.
Andy. So Andy Schoen, you are now the president of Revolt,
right.
Which is a 24-hour music network that is going to
right.
launch very soon.
Doing it again.
Yes.
Doing it again, yeah. Picking up where we left off in the late 90s, I think, you know, for the most part.
So one of the most interesting things that you said in the book, because we did an interview, I asked you some questions about MTV at that time, what made it special, and there has been on Twitter and on my Facebook page some argument as to whether or not the 90s really were the golden age of MTV. So you can settle this. Do you think that was the golden age, or am I being too optimistic?
Yeah, I mean, maybe selfishly, because that was our era there,
yeah.
But I think that...
I'm such a pain in the ass.
I know. I'm going to say yes.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of reasons. I mean, it was, you know, there was only one place to go to be influenced by music in the 90s. There was no Facebook. There's no social media. MTV had become so large by the 90s. Its influence was immense. And so I think that for artists, I think artists would say that the 90s, MTV was the biggest platform on earth, you know, to break artists.
Was that good for artists? Was it good for them that was really the only show in town and that there wasn't this sort of democratic marketing with social networking yeah. and YouTube and other outlets for them?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that, I'm not trying to plug my network, but one of the reasons that we're coming back and doing this again is we believe that artists having a platform on TV is a great thing. And they all love having a million plays on YouTube. But to have some curation, some centralized selection of the best of the best, of the things that that really can become popular on television is missing today. And there's still a place for it. It'll share the stage with many other things today that we didn't share it with in the 90s. But yeah, I think it is a good thing. Artists certainly had careers accelerated by it. It's much harder today to, as long as you're doing the right thing and you have people who are picking good things, you know, then yeah.
And we had a lot of artists at the time who were breaking, especially alternative acts, who were selling a million plus
yeah.
records, which it doesn't happen nowadays. I mean, a lot of bands go platinum selling singles, and the music industry is very different. Television
yeah.
is very different. What was MTV like when you inherited it in 1992? And you changed, you really had a big influence in the first couple of years, but tell me what you got, what you saw when you got there, and what were your first big moves?
Well, MTV in 1992 was having still a bit of a hangover from the hair band and metal era. And so, you know, I got there and I felt like MTV was playing the fifth Rat video or something, you know, sediment at the bottom of the metal tank, you know. It wasn't that strong. So I was actually really fortunate, and I think we capitalized on alternative and on rap music, which we worked to rebrand really as hip hop on MTV with MTV Jam. So I kind of came in that year with Nevermind from Nirvana under one arm and The Chronic from Dr. Dre under the other arm. And that became MTV Jams and Alternative Nation. And that brought, you know, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, you know, and Chili Peppers and, you know, Tupac and Biggie and all that to the channel in a bigger way, because we created vehicles in those programs to really bring that music more to the mainstream. And that pushed out the last vestiges of the hairband era, except for John Bon Jovi, who's still around today.
He's still around, miraculously.
Right. No, and you know, and much respect to him because he's really still relevant. But
Bon
for
Jovi,
the most part, everybody you know was pushed out.
Yeah, Bon Jovi played the iHeartRadio Music Festival last year.
Yeah.
You know, which is a huge seminal music festival that kind of does what MTV sought to do.
Yeah.
And how did you do it? I mean, how did you balance? Because when I got there, I remember that En Vogue was huge, and Nirvana and Pearl Jam were massive. But how did you get hip hop and R&B and alternative and you know different varieties of rock to exist in the same place and get the same audience of people excited by it? Was that a challenge?
Yeah, it was a challenge. But what's interesting today is you know you have Twitter as a one of the guys that works at my company today says Twitter is our dance floor. You know because we actually can do something and then you can get a reaction right away. You know in social media back then you know we didn't really know. We had a switchboard. People would call the MTV switchboard if they liked or didn't like something. Usually if they didn't like something, and we would do periodic research, focus groups and things. But I would say I think we had a good handle on the pulse of what that generation wanted at that time, but we couldn't have really known like you could know today. But what I would say that we were the national pop music channel of record, and so we had no choice but to play in a particular quarter hour. I remember we'd be playing, you know, Celine Dion's, you know, My Heart Will Go On, and Nirvana, and you know, En Vogue or something in the same 15 minutes. And it's because we could, like a top 40 station. So those things didn't always meld real well together, but it was the beginning of what we're experiencing today, which is sort of no genre barriers.
Yeah.
You definitely, there, you know, there's a, you can't really mix, for the most part, country with hip hop or hard rock or alternative. But you know, popular music, the most popular 200 singles or whatever mixed together, you know, it's you should you know what's on kids' iPods today. You know, there's a mix of all kinds of genres.
Yeah, and so much music.
I think that we did that too. So that's one of the things I'm proud of is that I came to MTV personally with a knowledge of alternative music from K-Rock where we worked together. And I left there with this vast knowledge of music across all these genres. And today, I still love all those genres like a lot of people who grew up at that
time. One of the most interesting things, and because MTV was so powerful and so important to record labels, and it was still this priceless real estate, how did you guys decide what videos to put on? Because I know there was a department, I don't even know if it exists anymore at MTV, I don't know how much music they play during the day, but it was called Talent and Artist Relations.
Yep.
And that was the nucleus, like the power nucleus at MTV that record labels desperately wanted to penetrate so they could get their videos on in regular rotation. How did you guys choose what music to play when?
Yeah, it was called Talent and Artist Relations, and then there was also music programming. And when I got there, I was the head of music programming, and there was also Talent and Artist Relations. And they thought that the balance of power was too big to have one department in charge of the music, so it was like this democratic process. And I said, the democratic process doesn't really work. And the record companies who, and the artists and the managers who, at that time, the power of MTV was so great that we essentially had customer service reps for the record companies that would then represent the music department that was looking at the research and the audience and deciding what to play. And I said, these are like people with a exotic sports car who want to talk to the mechanic, not the customer service rep, so let's combine them so that the record industry can go directly to the people making those decisions. So we did that. So that's sort of a long way around what that department is. So the music department at MTV was the one that you know picked the videos. And there was a process where they got submitted and we had a lunch every week and we looked at the new videos and there were typically anywhere from about 25 to 40 a week that would come in and we would look at them for a couple of hours.
I mean, that's a huge number.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think radio stations nowadays contemplate that many songs.
Probably not. But that process, we would look at anything that we had acquired that had come in that we could potentially play, and we'd watch them. And we wouldn't watch them all the way through. I mean, sometimes it was obvious. It would be 0% chance we're playing that, you know, and it would just come off, you know.
What's an example of something that you guys were really surprised by that just electrified the room that you weren't expecting, and you're like, oh, we have to play that?
You know what comes to mind is there are times when you're just looking for, because it is TV, so it's music, but it's also, it was television. And I remember it was the beginning of the summer, and this video came in, and it was, I was just kind of personally looking for something that felt like summer and was fun. And it was challenging in the 90s for MTV sometimes because a lot of the alternative music that was so popular, it wasn't great TV necessarily. It wasn't the pop music of the late 90s or early 2000s that was very popular. It was a lot of, you know, they call it shoegazing rock, you know, grunge. And I remember saying we need to call the industry, we need to call a meeting, we need to have an intervention and say, no more wet basements with a swinging bare light bulb in a video, you know? Because it was like, one more Mark Pellington video with like the wet floor in the basement. I think there's a hot water heater over there, there's a lamp, and there's, I think, you know? So there was a lot of that, but I remember Coolio, Fantastic Voyage.
Oh yeah.
Came in, and it was just this video. No one had ever heard of them. They were getting out of the trunk of the car or something, and it was. And I wish I could now remember the original track, but it was a remake of a, you know, it was a track from a popular 70s song, and I said, that just feels like summer. And it was like probably May or June. I said, let's just put that on. And everyone was kind of like, yeah, why not? It's a good song. It was, because it was a well-known hook, you know? And we put Coolio on, and that was the beginning of Coolio. And it was literally just saying, I like that. That feels like summer, you know?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it wasn't on the radio or anything, I don't think, at that time. It was just so that we were able to do that, you know, from time to time. But we did take our work, as you know, really, really seriously. You know, that music department of the 90s at MTV, some of the best debates and most thoughtful, passionate conversations I've ever experienced were in the meeting the next day, which was the actual music meeting. We took those videos, and then the next day, we would go in and we would debate what came off of this show and that show, what came off of Headbangers Ball, what was going into Alternative Nation, what was going on MTV Jams, what was going in regular rotation, what was going up in rotation, down in rotation, and those were passionate debates that were amazingly fun and powerful to be part of. And we took our work really seriously. We used to say, hey, we're shaping the way America rocks, you know?
Yeah.
Let's get in there and do this, you know? And like astronauts, you know, kind of do. But we really took the mission seriously and tried to do well, because we knew about the power that we had.
And one of the things that you talk about in the book that I wrote about in two chapters was the MTV Beach House.
Yeah.
Because you wanted to get out of the studio. You guys had to refurbish the studio, so we had to get out, you know, for practical purposes. But also, you wanted to bring kind of a spring break look the entire summer and have a party going all summer long, something that looked visually like summer when you turned on the TV. So tell me, how did the Beach House come to be?
Well, one of the dilemmas for MTV was, and I was brought in right after the 10th anniversary, from a background in radio programming, to try to figure out how to get the channel's ratings up. And it was a short form network. So just like CNN or the Weather Channel, we're playing short pieces of content, 4 minute pieces of content. So an hour was like 12 shows on MTV. It was 12 videos versus a narrative, you know, of you know, the competition we had on TBS would be, you know, a rerun of 90210 or something, and it had a story arc, and it would carry people through the hour once you got invested in a story. Well, we had a hard time with 12 stories an hour to get ratings, so MTV and ratings didn't go so well together. The novelty of videos had worn off, so we had to figure out ways to make them interesting again and to get people to watch them. So kids were, you know, had the remote in their hand, and they would see a video they didn't like, and they would say, that sucks, and they would go to an increasingly larger lap around, you know, cable or satellite to find, something else, and they'd come back an hour or two later. So we had to get them to put the remote down and watch things they didn't like and be, you know, waiting for things they did like. So that was what sort of smoke and mirrors long form programming, and that's what the packaging was of MTV Jams or Alternative Nation or the Beach House, which was kind of the, in many ways, I think the king of all of them, because it was not genre specific. It was just a place to go hang with MTV, and, you know, our strategy worked. You know, kids would put the remote down and say, that video sucks, that video's cool, that video sucks. But I want to see Kennedy in the Snapple hot tub with Coolio, you know, after this, or the Slim Jim tug of war, or whatever we had. So it was a product placement paradise.
Oh yeah,
but
no,
also,
I remember the Slurpee Slide. 7-Eleven sponsored the Slurpee Slide, which was literally, and Michael Bloom, who was the executive producer of the Beach House, he's here, but he can attest that we had a giant slip and slide that went down the slopey grass at the Malibu Beach House. It was covered in Slurpees. And it was so much fun. But it almost made you feel wrong because.
I know. I remember Bloom, he used to wear a big tiki or something. He used to be like, actually, or maybe I'm not supposed to say it because it was no one's supposed to know that that was actually him, but the tiki god or whatever it was. But so that worked great because, and I remember the day that I fought hard to bring the Beach House to MTV because it was a commitment to leave our studios and to do something differently. But I remember the day that the Beach House launched, we were in the office, it came on for the first time, and you just saw the blue sky and the ocean there in Quag, in the Hamptons, and the kids on the pool deck, you know, and the music playing, and it was The Grind, probably, which was our dance show at that time that came on after
Club by Eric Nice.
Eric Nice from
What's
Real
up?
World 1, that's right. So it came on, and you could feel it on the 24th floor in the middle of Times Square at our building, and you could, and a number of people, you know, crowded around the office and came down and talked about immediately how they said, I bet we're gonna get the numbers, you know, from this. And I remember getting an email, or not an email, couldn't have email then, a note, a handwritten
memo.
Note in one of those little envelopes with a string around it that came in with the mail guy, interdepartmental mail back then. And it was from Tom Freston, our chairman, who circled the ratings the next day. It came out at 3 the next day or whatever. Well done, Tom, you know? And we had doubled our ratings instantly.
You know who did not care for the doubled ratings? Mrs. Freston, who had a beach house
That's right.
just down the street from the first MTV beach house
right.
that we got kicked out of.
That's
so
right.
not only was
right.
everyone there in their 20s and single, and humping each other. But we were also loud. And everyone, the entire staff was living in the beach house. I mean,
that's
unthinkable. It's
these are the things
crazy.
That don't make it back to Manhattan that you don't realize.
Yeah.
So the idea of MTV going out to a beach house and packaging the music videos around the hosts and guests in a really fun fantasy place completely worked. And it proved out in the ratings, proved out with the advertisers. I think it made more money for Viacom than Titanic and Forrest Gump combined over the years. I mean, it probably made $1 billion in Skittles money and Pizza Hut and everything else, which is great. And I'm really proud of it because
we paid our extras for The Grind with. That's not a lot. They would get pizza and a Snapple and a handful of Skittles. Keep dancing, kids.
It definitely preserved my job for a long time. I can still dine out on being the beach house guy. It's where my career almost came to an end because I can't remember exactly, but I want to say that it was, I came back from the first really nice vacation I ever had at like a tropical destination, feeling all successful and everything. I'd never been to a high-end vacation. I came back, I was so relaxed. I got off the elevator, ding, and then Kurt Steffick, who worked with us, said, Freston's looking for you. Freston's looking for you. Serious. And I said, what? You know? And I believe he, I'll have to ask him, but I believe I went into his office and he said, Sean, you're dirt. And I'm like, I'm dirt? What are you talking about? And it was
dirt.
All about the beach house and this problem with the beach house and the craziness that had happened in his town, in his summer town. And Tom's an amazing, amazing guy, and it would not be like him to be troubled by anything like that.
But Mrs. Freston just kept calling, just kept calling.
Yeah,
and finally we got kicked out, but you said you went out there.
We moved down the street.
And you said that the people running the beach house had lost their minds and completely gone rogue.
Well, this is what it had. This is the part so it worked on TV. What I didn't think through was the fact that we just figured that everybody would just would live at the beach house all summer, kind of like the real world. But then they were really living together, and they were really all having sex with each other.
And then with each other's each other's.
And it became a real problem. And I got a call after a couple of weeks saying, this is like a weird lab experiment. And all the employees, I don't even know if it's legal or if there's an HR problem or what. I'm like, I didn't even think of that. And then, you know, there aren't any hotels out in the Hamptons.
No.
You know, so we took over.
No, people have multi-million dollar timeshares. Every
bed and breakfast, every motel room we could find all went to MTV employees for the whole summer.
So after that. And guess what? We
figured it out.
All right. So one of the stories that you and I are so intimately involved in, which is an entire chapter in the book. It should be called The Miracle I Didn't Get Fired. And that was
Which time?
When you really had to go to bat to save my job after the Rudy Giuliani incident.
Yeah.
Which Roseanne is on stage hosting the 1994 Video Music Awards.
Yeah.
She made some comment on stage that I had had oral sex with Rush Limbaugh. And then Bill Bellamy and the mayor of New York City, the new mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, who lobbied to get the VMAs back to New York, were all up on the balcony and we're soliciting votes for the Viewer's Choice Award. And as we go live, our faces go on the big screen at Radio City Music Hall and everyone starts booing.
Yeah.
And I panicked because I think they're booing me. I don't know if they're booing him.
Yeah.
No one boos Bill Bellamy. He's the nicest guy ever.
Right.
And so I panicked and start licking the microphone as though I'm having marital relations with my mouth, with the microphone.
Yeah.
And the crowd starts laughing.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a great moment that I have saved the day.
To get a laugh. Lick
it
a microphone.
Was. Yeah. And
yeah.
But the problem was I was standing next to
the
mayor of New York City
yeah.
on live television.
Yeah,
In front of every Viacom and MTV Networks executive.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize in the moment that that was a big deal, but apparently it was. What happened?
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. It was one of the several times that I had to answer for your behavior.
Can I just make a quick side? Because the first one, I started in September, November, you were like, can you please come into my office? And you played me from your voicemail a call from a standards and practices person, a switchboard operator, who said, can I use a bad word? Okay, who said, hi, I got a call at 3 in the morning from several angry viewers because apparently Kennedy said motherfucker. And I didn't. I said mother trucker.
Uh-huh,
but I said it so fast that.
Yeah.
And I'll never
That's
forget
good.
That.
It's like, a good way to do it.
You're like, did you say motherfucker? I'm like, no, I said mother trucker.
Yeah. Yeah.
From radio. I've never
said
that.
Yeah, come on, you know how to say that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the Giuliani incident, from your perspective, what happened?
Well, you know, on one hand, it's one of the reasons that we're here today and that people remember who Kennedy is and they can't remember all of the VJs, you know. There you go. The book, In Stores Now, or Tuesday, or whatever it is, is because you were a polarizing figure on there, okay? So people remember. Events like that actually, you know, while you didn't do it on purpose, in that case, those things helped you in a way, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't remember exactly. I know that it went up to Sumner Redstone, of course, who was the chair, you know, still is the chairman of Viacom that owns MTV. And I had a meeting and a conversation, and we discussed, whether or not, you know, you could stay or you needed to go. And it was not our way to let people go. We had a motto at MTV. They may still have it. I don't know. But we had a motto that we'd rather be sorry than safe. And so we did a lot of apologizing at MTV. And that was another one of the times we apologized and we got through it. And I think you wrote a letter.
I apologized to everyone the next day. And I didn't realize what a big deal was until I walked outside and I saw your face and you gave me this look like, what are you doing to me?
Right.
It's like, I've given you this huge opportunity.
Yeah.
What are you doing to
me?
And I see Fresnan as a joke. I said to Tom, like, hey, it was nice working with you. And he looked at me with such active contempt. I was like, what did I do?
Yeah.
And then I got a call from my manager who was watching the show live and was like, do you realize the amount of damage control this is going to take? He's like, I'm writing a letter right now that I'm going to have to FedEx to Tom Freston.
Oh, I know, because they worry about advertisers and all that. And if you think about it, the fact that there was a meeting that took place in a corporate setting to discuss you licking a microphone with the mayor, you know, and we had to have, like, you know, a meeting about it. Yeah. It's pretty funny at the end of the day.
It's funny now.
No, it's funny now, yeah. It's funny now. I smoothed it over.
Yeah,
right?
No, you had to smooth it over that night.
I smoothed it over.
Because another executive at MTV, Lauren Levine,
went
to a bar where you were all summiting at the bar, and Tom was very angry, and she made a joke about it that went over like a fart in church.
I think it's important to say that we talked about the Hamptons and Tom Freston being mad. We talked about that Giuliani thing. The reality is, greatest boss ever, and didn't get mad very often, and was incredibly supportive of everything we did.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for real. So,
Tom would always call me back.
Yeah.
I would call him just for fun, just to see if I could get him to call me back.
Yeah.
He would always call me back. He'd be on a private plane with Naomi
Campbell.
He'd
take your call right now if we called him, I think.
One of those big Gordon Gekko phones.
Yep.
And he would call my ass. It was great.
Yep.
So what do you take from MTV into Revolt? Because you're starting this 24-hour music channel. Will you mold it after your time at MTV? What successes do you take, and how do you change things, especially in light of the way technology and media are married now?
Yeah, I think in some ways, we'll take some of the parts from the 90s that were important to us. I mean, our commitment to artists and breaking artists, that same kind of passion that we had in those music meetings we have at Revolt today.
It's starting up. Do you have the same kind of music meetings?
We do, similar, yeah. The same kind of style. What's different today is we don't have that lunch. You can't have that organized lunch and those 40 videos and go through them and set them up like a chess game, you know, for the next month of your channel, because that stuff's being posted on YouTube and going out, you know, every day. And new interesting content by artists is being made and put on YouTube right now and out on social media or Vimeo or whatever it is, being tweeted and everything. So back when we were at MTV and we had that Supreme Power, I might have liked that Coolio video and said I like that, but there's no room for it this week because there's only 60 minutes in an hour, so you can only play so much. So we might say I like that, let's keep an eye on that, maybe play that in a couple weeks. You can't do that today because somebody else is going to beat you to it. Someone's going to build an audience or an affinity for that somewhere else. So we actually have to make our playlist every day, every hour. We have to break into programming when something cool gets posted or something new comes in. So that is different. So to be relevant to an audience today on television, and we're going out on Time Warner Cable and Comcast as a real industrial-sized cable channel in addition to our other platforms, to be relevant today, we've got to be live. We've got to be connected to social media.
So you'll be live.
We'll be live many hours a day.
Wow.
So the part of MTV that I always fought for coming from radio was live. You know, one of the last things we did was launch the Times Square studio, mm-hmm. you know, in the fall of 97. I think when TV is live, it's more exciting, you know, just like radio. You know, it's a live show versus a pre-recorded show. You just have a different feeling. And things can go wrong. And our job at Revolt is going to be really the global place for the conversation around music in very much a respectful, journalistic way. So to really give artists a platform again, to take TV back for artists who don't have that place anymore. I mean, MTV said goodbye to New York when they closed down TRL.
Yeah.
I saw Carson Daly and Kid Rock go to the window, and Carson said, say goodbye to New York, you know, and Kid Rock said goodbye to New York. And it felt weird because that commitment to music was shutting down. And so there are a lot of places to find music today. We're going to be a place where we'll be dedicated to it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And there really isn't a place like that on TV today with that kind of commitment.
Is that a failing on MTV's part?
No, I think MTV's incredibly successful, maybe more successful than ever today. And they're a mix of many things. They're really maybe they call themselves a youth culture network. And when we were there, we started that plan with
yes.
the 10 spot and more long form programming and animation and all that.
Style and MTV
sure.
Sports.
Absolutely,
and
yeah. So we started that trend and it built ratings like the Beach House was able to do that. And then over time, the balance was upset at MTV and they went maybe too far in one direction. But I can't say so because I think they've been very successful with the strategy they've had, and they have a huge audience and they've been very successful. So.
Well,
I know what we're doing, and we're going to try and play music on TV again.
I will
again.
Watch Revolt, and
thank you.
I know a lot of people, I host a morning music show, and people
yeah.
are desperate for music to be back on TV, so you're giving it to them. You
yeah.
gave me my first and second break. You gave me two careers, so thank you, Andy.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll do it again.
All right.
Okay.
So you can read all about Andy Schoen. The book is dedicated to him, and there's an entire interview.
Thank you for the dedication, by the way.
Oh,
it was
you're
very
so
sweet
welcome.
Of you.
Yes.
It was totally unnecessary. It was very sweet of you, though. It means a lot.
It was between
means
you
a lot.
And Ricky Rackman.
Well, thank you.
And
thank you.
Frankly, you've got a nicer car.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. And thank you for watching. You can check out more videos, music, and otherwise. Always at Reason TV. And for Reason TV. I'm